you'd like to turn to Hebrews, the 12th chapter, we'll be looking at verses 18 through 24 tonight. In a scene out of the book of Tom Sawyer, Tom has gone to Sunday school at the demand of Aunt Polly. And after Sunday school, Tom and his brother Sid went into the auditorium to sit under her watchful eye. And he says that the announcements are made from a list that would stretch on to the crack of doom. The prayer, to use his words, was generous in its details. And furthermore, Tom is so familiar with the prayer that he knows it by heart. And so he recognizes and resents any new additions that come to the prayer. And he says that the preacher's sermon drones on monotonously through an argument that is so prosy that many a head begin to nod. Basically, a worship service bores Tom. And it may be through Tom's descriptions reminds us of similar experiences in our own lives, especially when you think of your childhood. I think we've all experienced public worship when it was less than invigorating. Unfortunately, there have been many people who have come to expect worship to be dull and trivial and boring. The time in worship is used to think about what's maybe for lunch or dinner, or how the ball game is going to go, and doing mental gymnastics to try to survive another service. Maybe you count tiles on the ceiling. Maybe you see how long you can hold your breath, or you find, this is one of my favorites, the longest song in the songbook. Rather than a positive experience, worship has become a ritual to endure. And it's true, as a performance, worship hardly ranks up with anything we see on TV or at the movies. I can't begin to compete with something that you're going to see on that. As for excitement, our worship service doesn't come close to a football game. So the question becomes, why go to church? And I mean that phrase, why go to worship services? It's a question that probably wasn't asked 30 years ago in any communities because it was commonly assumed that church attendance was important. But in our day and time, a lot of people ask that question, why go to church? And some people go because they always have. It's out of habit. Others attend because it's expected within their community or their social circle. Some have never been part of a church life, and so they question the value of attendance. Sunday morning becomes a time to recuperate from Saturday night, or a time to get some work done around the house. I think it's safe to say today attendance at worship has very little relationship to God's demands with Christian lives, is how a lot of people would put it. You hear a lot of people say, I have a strong faith in God, but I just don't think it's that important to attend church. So going to church seems to be the custom of people who insist on maintaining an old tradition. But I'd like to suggest tonight that we need our times of worship together. And I understand that worship can take place away from our regular meeting place, but we need these special times that are set aside for worship. If we didn't have these special times, we would tend to lose our perspective on life and our sense of values. We begin to think about things that only are real, that aren't real in our lives, the only things that we can see and touch that matter. And it's hard to live as Christians in a society who doesn't really think that much of God or know anything beyond material existence. Tagore, a great Indian mystic, once wrote a poem comparing our lives to a narrow lane which is lined with high buildings, and there's only a single strip of blue sky above. And this poem is wrote from the Lane's perspective, and it only sees that bit of blue sky for moments at a day. And she asks herself, is it real? The noise of the traffic, the carts, the garbage, the smoke, all of these things the Lane accepts as real and actual things of life. And before long, it ceases to wonder about that blue strip above. And I think that's a good way of describing how our own lives are like. We are all surrounded by things of this world all week long. And after a while, we begin to accept them as what is real. And we forget about that streak of blue above. But worship is our time to be reminded of what is real to us. In our worship, in our singing of spiritual songs, in the preaching of God's word, we come to the heavenly Jerusalem. I think it's very interesting that only in Hebrews, among all the books in the New Testament, provides us with a real answer on why go to church. The other books in the New Testament probably don't deal with this problem because the importance of church attendance was never really questioned early on. Early Christians knew they needed to be present in the frequent, even daily gatherings of the disciples. In Acts, the second chapter, in verse 46, it says, continually daily with one accord in the temple, and with the breaking of bread from house to house, they ate their food with gladness and simplicity of the heart, praising God and having favor with all the people. But by the time the book of Hebrews is written, some of the Christians had developed a disturbing habit of neglecting the assembly. The Hebrew writer admonished them, saying, let us consider one another in order to stir up love and good works, not forsaking the assembly of ourselves, of assembling ourselves together as in the manner of some, but exhorting one another, and so much more as you see as the day approaches. We don't know all of the reasons why they weren't attending worship. But Hebrews does tell us a big part of their problem was a deep spiritual weariness. The Christian life was something that was difficult, and they were getting tired. They had drooping hands and weak knees, as it's described in Hebrews 12:12. They were in danger of drifting away. They looked back at Judaism with all of its pomp and pageantry, and there were aspects of it that they truly missed. And I think that it's safe to say, to some extent, they were bored with the worship service of the church. And so they quit. They no longer attended worship. And I suppose their reasons for neglecting the assembly may be very much like those of Christians today. Maybe they found worship too simple and too plain. It was hardly a match for any of the pagan rituals going on down the street, or even Judaism, which they had just came out of. The worship must have appeared terribly unspectacular. To them, worship consisted of merely singing hymns and preaching the word, breaking bread and prayer. And they may have complained that nothing was happening there. There was no pageantry. There was no excitement. And so they dropped away from the church. They were tired of the routine. And it's a great tragedy when our brothers and sisters drop out. Because dropping out of church isn't like quitting a club. It's more like throwing away a precious treasure. It's like choosing a worthless trinket that you now have in place of something that was of far greater value. Hebrews 12:15 says that we are to look diligently lest anyone fall short of the grace of God. And the reason is that we are our brother's keeper. In verses 16 and 17, the Hebrews writer reminds us of Esau, who threw away his precious inheritance for a bowl of stew. And we, of course, read that in Genesis 25. Because he was the firstborn, Esau had the birthright. He had a double portion of his father's inheritance. It gave him all of the advantages of being a patriarch. But as important as his birthright was, Esau gave it up for a bowl of stew. And it was a foolish thing to do. And the point that the Hebrew writer is trying to make is that we need to see to it that nobody makes the same mistake by leaving the church for an insignificant thing that this world has to offer. You might expect the writer of Hebrews to encourage his readers to return to church by suggesting that worship could be made more exciting. Or you might expect him to encourage the church to match those worship to the tastes of the audience, to find out what they want and to give it to them. After all, that is what we try to do sometimes today. Several years ago, ABC News did a special entitled In the Name of God, and it explored various different religious groups in the country and what they were doing to try to make people more excited about going to church. The charismatic element, the use of what they called holy laughter, everything was designed to make the worship experience as exciting as possible for those attending. And it works to a degree. Some places see people come in by the thousands, but there was nothing done that was glorifying God. Rather, it was designed with the apparent purpose of making feel good. And so they could truly say they went somewhere and they enjoyed themselves. It reminds me of when Jesus said to the woman at the well about the Samaritans in general. He said, "You worship what you do not know." And I think there are a lot of people who don't quite know what they are worshiping. They may make an honest claim that they are worshiping God, and that really is what they believe, but they've replaced the element of God with themselves. And so we circle back around to that question, why attend church? In chapter 12, the Hebrews writer gives us a simple but powerful reason why we should attend worship service. In this passage, the Hebrew writer describes what happens every time we come to worship, even when we are not emotionally moved. And these words might have been read to a small congregation meeting in someone's home. Nothing about the assembly would look very impressive. And yet the Hebrew writer wanted this congregation to know that something very important was going on every time they met. Verse 18 begins, "For you have not come to the mountain that may be touched, that may be burned with fire, and to blackness and darkness and the tempest, and at the sound of the trumpet and the voice of words, so that those who heard it begged that the word should not be spoken to them anymore, for they could not endure what was commanded. And if so much as a beast touches the mountain, it shall be stoned or thrust through with an arrow. And so terrifying was the sight that Moses said, 'I am exceedingly afraid and trembling.'" And you have to imagine yourself as an Israelite living somewhere around the 15th century BC. And you've spent your entire life in the land of Egypt as a slave. Your whole existence has been at the bidding of an Egyptian taskmaster. And there's a pyramid there in the dedication of Ramses that is a testimony to your labor. But now you have a man named Moses who has came on the scene and appears to be a spokesman for a God of your ancestors. The power of this God named Jehovah has humbled the mighty Egyptian empire. And now, for the first time in your life, you are free. And you've just made a treacherous journey through the desert of Sinai. And it's obvious that you're being led there by God Himself. You have a pillar of cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night that is leading you onward. Your life has been spared by the Egyptians at the Red Sea and from hunger and thirst in the desert by direct intervention of God Himself. And now you finally stand at the foot of the mountain upon which Moses first met God some 40 years ago. Your joy at completing a long journey through the wilderness is short-lived, though, because it's replaced with absolute terror. You have witnessed the plagues that brought the Pharaoh to his knees. You have witnessed an entire army being drowned in the sea, but you've never seen anything as terrible and as frightening or as awesome as this. The mountain that rises up before you is covered by a thick cloud. and the darkness is repeatedly pierced by flashes of lightning. The silence is shattered by rumblings of thunder. A blasting trumpet announces what you already know, that God is on the mountain. You have to struggle to keep your balance because the great earthquake is rumbling and your knees are just shaky anyway. And Moses disappears into the cloud, and then he returns to warn you not to approach the mountain or else you'll die. But he doesn't really need to tell you to do that because there wasn't a whole lot that were going to take that chance to go near that terrible place. And then the most terrible and awesome thing yet takes place. Through a cracking of the thunder and the rumbling of the earthquake, a voice is heard by all the people that I am the Lord your God who has brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. God himself begins speaking from the mountain, giving out the Ten Commandments. And the experience is so terrifying that you plead with Moses to go and speak to God for you because you're convinced if you hear God speak again, you're going to die. And so I ask this question tonight. Do you think if you really witnessed that scene that I've just described, that you might have a different view of worship than you do right now? If you had been there at the foot of Mount Sinai, would you have wondered why it was so important to worship God? The greatness and glory and grandeur of God would naturally drive you to want to worship Him. It's only natural that the Israelites went to their knees before God. And that is what the Hebrews writer is describing here in chapter 12. He's saying, just think, if we were in a situation like that, we could appreciate worship so much more. If every time that we prayed, the lights flickered and the floor trembled, we would know that we were having a meaningful worship. But the Hebrew writer says that's not what our worship is like. He says, you have not come to the mountain that may be touched. And he compared what those Israelites experienced to what our worship is. But the Hebrew writer wants us to know that there is a tremendous significance of what we do. He says, you have come to Mount Zion and to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem. Christians, even those in those small congregations that may seem plain and unimpressive, have come to Mount Zion. And it's one of the greatest blessings of the Christian faith that we've been invited to draw near to God in worship. Christians are on holy ground in weekly worship assembly. The bricks and mortar, the pulpit and the pews, they're not sacred. But whenever God the Father and Jesus the Son are present, we need to respond to that presence by figuratively removing our shoes in reverent, prayerful worship. Have you ever thought about what happens in worship, even when you're not in the mood to be singing or the preaching isn't quite as enjoyable as you'd like? It may not look like much, but when we worship, we do come before God. The Hebrew author may well have asked them, do you realize with whom you are meeting? There's a story that a congregation had invited Henry Ward Beecher to come preach for them one Sunday. And as it turned out, however, he couldn't go. And so he sent his brother to preach in his place. And his word got around the congregation. Several people started to leave. And his brother stood up and made the announcement. Those of you who came to hear my brother speak may leave at this time. Those of you who came to worship God, I urge you to stay. A similar tale is one of a tourist in Washington, D.C., who telephoned the minister of the church where President Franklin Roosevelt often worshiped. And that tourist wanted to know if the president was going to be there that Sunday. And the minister replied that, I don't know for certain, but I can tell you that we are expecting God to be here, and we hope his presence will attract a sizable crowd. I don't know that any of us could not help but be impressed and maybe a little bit awed by the presence of someone of celebrity status. If we had someone come in that was of that status that wanted to worship with us, It would be hard not to say that next day, guess who came to our church service? And I think that together, or that we forget as we gather, that we are in the presence of the Almighty God. We are a privileged audience to have with the King of creation. And we enter His palace and we kneel before His throne and speak our humble praises and receive the divine blessing. But it's always tempting for us to judge the quality of worship by the beauty in the setting or the impressiveness of what we see and what we hear. The Israelites approached God in a scene that was tangible and was terrifying to the senses. They could see with their own eyes the glory of God. They could hear with their ears the power of God. But our worship is different. The Hebrew writer says, "You have not come to the mountain that may be touched." Our worship may not look impressive, but we need to be careful that we never forget that we are in the presence of God. And that's what happens every time we meet for worship. But worship is more than just a time to meet with God. And the Hebrew writer wants his readers to understand the full significance of their worship together. In verse 22, it says, "But you have come to Mount Zion and to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, to innumerable company of angels, to the general assembly of the church of the firstborn who are registered in heaven, to God the judge of all, and to the spirits of men made perfect, to Jesus the mediator of the new covenant, and to the blood of the sprinkling that speaks better things than that of Abel." When we think of worship as a time of fellowship with our brothers and sisters in this area, but it really is so much more than that. The Hebrew writer says that you are in the presence of thousands upon thousands of angels in joyful assembly. And to me, that is just a mind-boggling thought to think about, that we are in the presence of angels in our worship. That we come to the church of the firstborn, whose names are written in heaven. Our worship is worldwide fellowship. Communities like ours meet around the world to sing "How Great Thou Art" in Brazil, in Russia, Scotland, South Africa, New Zealand, in various different languages. Christians are meeting to remember the death of Jesus Christ by sharing in the Lord's Supper. And it helps to remember that we worship with this bond that we share with Christians around the world. We come to God, the judge of all men. Even when worship is routine, God is still present. In ancient Israel, He was present in the fire and darkness and gloom. But for us, He is present in the reading of His word and the offering of our praise. Our God is a consuming fire, and we should come before Him in awe. We come before the spirits of righteous men made perfect. We are united in a heritage and a sharing and a fellowship with those who have lived before us, the great heroes of faith that are described in Hebrews 11, our spectators that sit in the stadium and cheer us on as we finish the race, as well as early Christians like Peter and Paul and Timothy and Barnabas. We are in danger of living for the moment by losing contact with the past. But in worship, we share with those who have preceded us. But above all of that, we come to Jesus, the mediator of the new covenant, and to the sprinkled blood that speaks better word than the blood of Abel. In our worship, the blood of Christ speaks to us. We come as sinners, having failed to live up to God's standard. We come as failed parents, as failed sons and daughters, husbands and wives. We come with a spiritual pride that makes us feel secure and separates us from the others. In worship, we come to the one who speaks to us words of consolation and forgiveness. Realizing that worship in an assembly with God and angels seems incredible that anyone would be careless or flippant about going to church. To neglect worship is to enjoy the things we can see and touch. To me, is absurd. But like Esau, we are always tempted to throw it away for the lasting gift that no one can have now. We're like the children of Israel. We give up on God's promise for the future for the sake of ease and comfort now. But when we neglect worship, we throw away the lasting possession. There was once a radio personality in the western part of Idaho who got a letter from a shepherd. And the shepherd asked him if he will strike the single note of A, that I'm a sheep herder out here in the wilderness, and I don't have any way to tune my violin. And if you would just strike an A, I might be able to get it in tune. And so the radio personality honored the request, and a few weeks later he received a letter back that said, "Now I am in tune." One of the purposes of worship together is to enable us to be tuned to the Great Shepherd. We live in an ever-changing world. We experience rapid changes in technology. The state of the art of computer today is probably going to be obsolete in 2 to 3 years. Our society is so mobile that we can't seem to keep our friends and acquaintances for very long periods at a time. Beliefs and moral standards are constantly changing. There are so many changes around us that we have no power to prevent. We need one area of our life that is stable and that is able to give us a sense of security. The author of Hebrews tells his tired community that Christians have an anchor for their lives. He pictures there at the end of chapter 12 the end of everything. He talks about the world's destruction and the end of all material things, but he also refers to the abiding of those heavenly realities that cannot be shaken. And then he draws this conclusion in verses 28 and 29. Therefore, since we are receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken, let us be thankful. And so worship God acceptably with reverence and awe, for our God is a consuming fire. In a world that's always filled with change, we find worship in a kingdom that cannot be shaken. We come together every Lord's Day to be in the presence of God. Even though it may not always look like much, maybe we don't leave with that feeling of excitement, but what takes place here is of great significance, because this is where we approach Mount Zion, and this is where we offer our praise to the one who is worthy of all praise. And may we never, as Christians, take this opportunity in a light manner. The invitation is open for anyone tonight that needs to seek God. We encourage you not to delay. If you've fallen away from your walk with Christ, again, we encourage you to right that ship, so to speak. And we encourage you to do that as together we stand and we sing.